You're just a pair of eyes poking out of the background. Hi everyone, welcome back to Plate in the System, a podcast all about creativity, process and making things. Today we are very lucky to be joined by Professor David Gauntlett of Toronto Metropolitan University. How are you, Professor David Gauntlett? No, that's not Professor David Gauntlett, is it? No, David will be coming up later. And David will be talking to us about his brand new amazing book called Creativity by David Gauntlett. And what I love about this, many things I love about this, but it's a manual for creativity. It's a book to essentially facilitate more creativity. And anyone who ever makes anything knows how useful that is. So this book is about seven keys to unlock your creative self. And we're going to deep dive into all of those seven keys. So when you've listened to the podcast, you will realise how brilliant this book is. And you can buy it on a physical copy. Or, like me, if you struggle to read, you can get the audiobook and have David read it to you himself, which is totally awesome. So in this podcast, before we kick off, I like to do the down the rabbit hole section. And Down the Rabbit Hole is a musical task where we kind of talk through a process. And I thought it would be great to take a challenge from David's book. So I've got my trusty bookmark here, which is actually a beautiful ribbon cable. And in this, David sets tasks for you as a creative practitioner. And one of the tasks that he set, I thought would be a brilliant challenge for the Down the Rabbit Hole section is, well, I can't actually phrase it correctly, so I'm just going to read it out. So for you, what is the smallest possible element of your creative practice that you can do? Just doing the simplest possible thing and then being satisfied that that is pleasing and enough can be perfect. And then recall the point from Michael Rother. If you can appreciate this 5% of the horizon and note its charm, its lightness, its details, that can be more than enough. It can offer you a whole world. And there's a lovely little drawing there of one of David's lines. He set up a drawing project and tried to create the artist just tracing the line with his finger. Yeah, set up to create a one-line drawing. So I've attempted this challenge, as has Hazel, has done a version of the minimalist challenge, as had David, and it's really tough. So I would encourage you all to try this challenge. It's a really interesting exploration of who you feel like you are and boiling that down to the kind of essence, the musical essence of Eunice. I think my final thing I want to say is that I am launching a new creative project under the name Climber. Climber's my middle name, and I've been peppering around this idea for a long time. That's a nice face, Artie. And this is it's an electronic project, and I've joined a brilliant Web3-based community called Wild Awake. And it's all about using Web3 technologies to build a creative community, to build something that can support artists, can support each other. So my single under Climber is called The Circling Sky, and it's going to be released on June the 22nd. And I'll put some links to the Mirror Post and the Collective in the show notes. So thanks again for tuning in. Please like the podcast and give it a good review if you think it's worth it. It always helps to have your support and gives me the encouragement to keep going. So thanks again for tuning in. I hope you enjoy the show. And here we go down the rabbit hole. Okay, so in this section, down the rabbit hole, we are looking at the simplest idea possible. So this is an idea taken from David's book. And it's about just doing the simplest thing possible and being satisfied that that is pleasing enough and can be perfect. Now, anyone who's ever made any work, any music, will certainly resonate with this idea that I don't think I've ever heard a piece of music where I think, oh, that could do with more things in it. Even John Cage's 4-3-3. So I think we often overpack things with too many ideas, too much stuff, and things are usually always better when we simplify them. So yeah, we're going to hear three different simplest musical ideas, one from David Gauntlett, one from Hazel, who is work experiencing with me at the moment, who I asked to do it, and one from me. So I'm going to put them on and listen to them on the headphones, and I'll probably speed up the bit of me listening to it and then just comment at the end. Okay. So the first one up, this is David Gauntlett's piece. That's amazing. I think actually that is probably one of my favourite pieces of music that I've heard David make. And the sense of kind of ambisonic sort of belonging is quite incredible. It sort of sounds as if I'm in a sort of, sound forest. Really incredible stuff. Nice work, David. Okay, next up, we're going to listen to Hazel's piece. Amazing. So again, it's interesting, isn't it, when you ask someone to create the simplest musical idea, that you've really got to boil down your essence as a musician and who you really are trying to be. And that was equally beautiful to David's piece, but very different. David almost was sort of distancing himself from the musicality, and this is a piece full of rich musicality and harmony. Okay, cool. Do you want to play up my piece? So yeah, to me, the reason I composed that was it has echoes of the things I love, a piece on the Global Communication album that has that cyclic pattern. It also reminds me of a amazing buzzy thing in the room, which is adding to my ambisonic experience. Doesn't seem to want to leave the building. I'm going to go and usher him out. Yeah, that reminds me, that sort of repetitive riff reminded me of a piece by Global Communication and also a piece by Tangerine Dream. I've always loved those sort of slightly minor key, repetitive cyclic patterns, and then introduce some delay and kind of phasing from Steve Reich and those kind of ideas. So it just felt to me that that kind of melodic motif was mostly who I identify as, along with a kind of cyclic repetitive pattern. And I can imagine that sort of flat seven, flat six bass line bringing out that kind of melodic minor, which is something that Megan, my wife, who's much more musically advanced than I am, constantly gets quite irritated about, but does identify as something that I do pretty much in all pieces of music. So yeah, that was down the rabbit hole. I'd be really interested to hear your simplest versions, your most minimal idea. So yeah, send me them in if you want me to put them on the show. That'll be fantastic, to put them in the next episode. But yeah, it's a really interesting concept and something I encourage you to do. So that wraps up Down the Rabbit Hole. Now let's hear from David Gauntlett.
So welcome, David. It's nice to
Hello.
Catch up. When did we last talk? Can you remember?
Actual talking? I don't know, I'm sorry. But it was
quite
very,
a lot
very
of emailing. Yeah, we've done a lot of emailing.
In my heart. We have done that.
We can do this podcast one of two ways. We can do it the ordered way or the chaos way. But work-life balance and time is something you talk about extensively in your book.
Yeah.
Making time. And I love this concept, making time. I hadn't thought about the words literally until I read them. Making time. One can't make time. Time progresses, arguably, with or without us.
Yes, you just thinking have to punch up your own little pile of it. Yeah.
So, but you can't make time. You can merely create space to do that thing in, which we call making time. But it's just, it's a funny word, because literally speaking, to make time, you can't add more time in to make time.
That's true. Yeah. All you could do is try to shove some things aside from time to time so that you can actually do it.
So it's it's a reductive process rather than a adding process. It's taking things away. It's a minimalist approach rather than a maximalist approach.
If you say so. Okay, I don't want to start on this point. This sounds like the best thing you liked about the whole book was one word.
No, that's what I'm saying. So when I was listening to the book, this is the tangents my brain goes in. And because I've just listened to the audio book and I couldn't interrupt you and tell you what tangents my brain was on, I'm now taking that opportunity to say, this was where my brain spiraled. Anyway, let's start at the beginning. So as I was... I listened to the book, which I love, Walking Around Ashdown Forest.
Thank you.
And as I was walking this morning, I bumped into my neighbour, Hallie, who is a sculptor. Hallie's never listened to a podcast before, so I said I'd give him a shout out. Hi, Hallie. Welcome to your first podcast. It's a wonderful world. I'm sure you're going to love it. And I explained what I was doing, and I was interviewing Professor David Gauntlett, who is a professor of creativity. And Hallie said... what does he make? So I thought, I'll ask you that question. David, what do you make?
Well, I make a range of things. The thing I most enjoy making is music, but I also make books, teaching experiences, other events and workshops and experiences for humans to participate in. And occasionally, obviously... other things are made by me, including meals, CD packages. I enjoyed making CD. I mean, it's amazing how your attitude to a thing can change very quickly once you've bought into it yourself. Because, like, if 6 months before I made a CD, somebody gave me a CD, I would definitely have thought, what are you doing? Nobody listens to CDs. What is this? It's ridiculous. And I wouldn't have respected it at all, even if they'd made some nice packaging for it, I don't think. But then once I decided that, vinyl is extremely time-consuming, well, you know, I was told it would be 7 months to generate a record after the point when I give them all the final stuff. I say, could I get in the queue? And then... you know, 7 months would pass, and just before the end of the 7 months, I could give you the actual stuff, and then you make the record. They said no. That didn't work. CDs, very cheap and easy and quick to make, and you can make a nice little package from it. So then I think that CDs are an exciting thing, and I got all obsessed with all the different sorts of CD packaging you can do and all of that. Because it's nice to have a physical product, even if it's one that almost nobody can play.
Yeah.
But it's a thing. So I think that you can listen to it on Spotify, and you can have the physical product and look at the little liner notes and the little my pictures and all of that. You don't actually have to get the audio from the thing that's in your hand.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I don't actually have a CD player. And exactly what I did was, yeah, I held the CD, I looked at the artwork, I read the gubbins, yes, and listened to it on Spotify. Yes.
Perfect.
So I did exactly what you expected, and felt slightly guilty that I didn't actually, and have never played the CD. But I do now have a CD player.
Okay.
So I will play the CD. But
why
it's
did you
interesting.
Acquire a CD player?
I think, like you, my ding has just gone off, so I'm going to try and put myself on this new focus mode. I can't find it.
Then I will say, why did you buy a CD player?
I can't do two things at the same time. Where is
I'm trying to help you with your editing.
Oh, yeah, I don't really edit. I'll just leave it to do.
Okay, well...
I will edit this bit out, but I don't normally edit. I kind of roll for an editing thing, but normally I've put my focus mode on. Ah, there it is. Focus mode.
I mean...
Brill.
People like to listen to you searching for focus mode, I'm sure.
I try and take these podcasts as if you were recording direct to acetate back in the 1930s, yeah, because if you get it into your head that you're not going to post edit, then you do approach it in a different way.
Yes.
And then it makes me do more podcasts, because editing exponentially takes so much longer than actually recording it in the first place.
Yeah.
So we'll go back to the CD. Why did I buy a CD player? It's very interesting to hear your thoughts on creativity and making, because like you, the digital era came along, the iPod came along, and we all were bowled over by how wonderful this device was, that we could literally have every single song in the world ever in our pocket on a machine. And we fell wholeheartedly down the rabbit hole of that. And about 10 years later, some people, I think, started to wonder exactly what we'd signed up for. And I have been returning to physical products, tapes, CDs and vinyl. And I feel slightly queasy about this, because I've been up until now a futurist, and I know that culture and society at large will not go backwards to this form en masse. But when I buy a record, it's like the music is better. I have such a deeper connection with that art than I do on a streaming platform or any other medium. And I think people talk about how records sound better. I did an A/B test on this for my own amusement. And like all things audio, it's not a binary CDs, vinyl, streaming sound better or worse. So, for example, a poorly mastered Sly and the Family Stone digital reissue sounds terrible compared to the original 1970s vinyl. And by terrible, I mean in terms of depth, warmth, emotional engagement with the music. But a modern vinyl pressing of probably a digital recording in the first place actually sounds remarkably close, because there isn't really any vinyl crackle on a modern vinyl. That kind of comes with age. And there wasn't really a right lot of difference. So that aside, it's about my connection with the artwork. And it brings much more value to me to have less and engage on a much deeper level with that less. So I'll buy probably two records a month. And I really think about those records, because they're 30 quid each. You know, that's I'm still spending £800 a year on vinyl. But those two records get played and played and played, and I sit down and I really listen to them in a really deep way. I can't take them out the house. So I can only engage with them in a limited time frame, and that makes it all the more special. So that's why I bought a CD player, because I thought, you know, it would be great to enjoy that same experience with CDs. But interestingly, I don't know about the world, but it seems to me that people are reading less Kindle books and actually going back to actual books. So that's a retrograde step, right?
Yeah. I still wish that they would do that thing where you get the Kindle book and the physical book at the same time. In some cases, I've paid for both, because I quite like to be able... Yeah. I like to see the thing as a thing, and sometimes like to get a sense of, like, how big it is. Well, on a Kindle book, what chapter I want to read. I would have both as a bundle, please.
This drives me mad about the music industry. So in the book industry, I buy often, if I really like the book, I buy the physical one and the audio book. And I still don't have the Kindle version, which I need sometimes for referencing or work. In music, the music industry made such a mistake that on the vinyl, you often get the vinyl, the download code, and the CD in one package.
Oh, and you're saying that's a mistake because they could have made more money by not doing that?
Yeah. No.
All right, okay, I'm the opposite to you. I'm saying that the book people should do what the music people are doing, and you're saying that the music people are losing money because they should have just tricked us into paying for it three times, which, you know.
But I'm with the creators, and as a musician professionally, the music industry's made so many mistakes on behalf of professional creatives. That if you reduce a top earning musician's income by 50,000 a year, they don't even notice. Taylor Swift, Drake, Ed Sheeran, they wouldn't notice if their income went down 40 grand a year. But for an alternative, I'm not going to say low level musician because it's not about that, but for a alternative musician, the difference between 5 grand a year and 45 grand a year is astronomical. It's the difference of whether you can or can't carry on doing it.
Yes. Remind me where your 40 grand came from in this bit of conversation.
Just that in the music industry, they're so desperate for you to even spend any money at all that you get unlimited Spotify for £10 a month. You can't get a good unlimited Kindle subscription.
Mm.
And on top of that, you can buy the book, still not have the download, buy the audiobook as well as the book, still not have the download Kindle version. So if you want it, again, you've got to buy the Kindle version. I think they do give you a Whisper Sync slight discount, but again, that never seems to work. Mm. So I don't even get that either. So I'm basically buying the same thing three times in three formats in some cases.
Yes. We should probably move on from this because we're just trying to solve Jeff Bezos's business model for him. But I think, like, instead of a £15 book, I'd like to spend £20 for which I get the book and the Kindle, so I don't have to buy both of those things for £15 kind of thing.
Yeah, I would get the bundle
because
too.
That seems a bit much.
So yeah, what I said to my neighbour Hallie about what you make, I said, David makes lots of things. I said he makes books. And he makes music. But I said, to me, the thing that David makes the most is the space for people to make things in. So you're a maker of space. And
okay, I'll take that.
And I think that's a really incredible thing to do in this time of what feels like even more growing capitalist agendas and neoliberal economies, that your book really seems to address at the very heart that creativity is a human condition, and that it argues, I think brilliantly, that everyone's creativity and contribution is valid, because without it there is nothing. No one makes just one massive thing. It doesn't work like that. It has to grow. It has to start small. And I've not heard that argument quite put in that clarity before, and I loved it.
Hmm.
So I thought I'd start. So I've written my notes here.
Can I just say about that?
Yeah, go on.
I like that thing that you said, that I make space for creativity. And often when people talk about making space or spaces for creativity, they're talking about physical spaces, aren't they? Like, I've set up a maker space in the basement of the university, or that kind of thing. That's what they're talking about. But I like the sense in which I've created a mental or metaphorical space for that. I don't read loads of academic articles, even though I should, but I saw a nice one which was about the studio. This is part of practice-based research, which is a thing we teach. We do a practice-based research PhD at Toronto Metropolitan University. And I like all of the stuff about that. All of that is gripping to me in a way that no other academic stuff is. And there was a thing about studio being potentially a thing in your mind, like the idea of every creator needs a studio, but we don't all have the privilege to have actual, you know, big physical spaces. He said to a man sitting in his big physical space full of things. Obviously, I've got a room with some books in it. But the idea that your studio can be in your mind, like a kind of mind palace, I like that. That was a very appealing idea that your studio really lives in your mind. You carry it around with you all the time. This is where you're doing the stuff. Sometimes you're actually doing the stuff. Sometimes you're apparently not doing the stuff. But in your mind, there might still be some bit of your mind that's working on the stuff. Hmm. That's nice. I like that. And on the other thing you said, I really liked it when I eventually boiled it down to the idea that creativity is a thing that you do, which is like one paragraph in the book somewhere. I really like that idea, which, you know, I've been talking about creativity for years and years and years and years and never really thought of it quite like that. But the thing that it's really common for us to look at other people and go, oh, he's really creative or she's really creative. People often think, oh, I'm not so creative. They're more creative. But all you mean is that this is a person who has evidently allocated some time, going back to that point, allocated some time to doing creative stuff. That's what they've done. The reason why you look at them and go, oh, they're really creative, it just means they've spent time doing the creative stuff. Therefore, they've arrived at some creative stuff, and you look at the stuff and you think, oh, they're really creative, so that's good. And I'm not saying they're not creative, they are creative. But then many of us would seem just as creative if we had allocated that amount of time. They've allocated the time, very sensible. Others of us don't so much, and then maybe we don't seem so creative. But it's just creativity is a thing that you do, and if you put some time into doing it, then you'll get better at it, you'll do more of it, you'll have experience of it. And also, you contribute to the body of work. The other thing I like these days, which I thought of even more recently, even though it seems really obvious, should have thought of that ages ago, just the idea of the body of work, so that, which takes the pressure off. So every time you're making a thing, we always want each thing that we're making to be some like beautiful little masterpiece, make it perfect, be the most perfect thing we've ever done. But if you think of it as just adding to your body of work, it's another thing, and you'll do that as well as you can, and then you'll move on and make another thing and add that to your body of work. And just the idea of a growing body of work seems nice to me, and anything that takes the pressure off tends to be quite good, doesn't it? The other thought I had that's a bit like that is, what was it? There's something that's a bit like that. Side projects. So if you have things that you think aren't really your main thing, it's just some kind of side project thing that you do on the side, then that can be where some of the best ideas come, or which is more experimental or weird, because you're not really trying to fulfill anything in particular. It's just some kind of side thing that you're doing. And then that can be where the most interesting stuff happens. And that is at least in part because you didn't think it was that important. And so because you've taken the pressure off, then that's where the interesting things happen.
That's a really interesting concept, isn't it? Pressure, because I do this podcast, and even though there's been a massive gap for personal reasons, I put no pressure on myself for this podcast because I don't want to be a podcaster. I have no concept of being a professional podcaster or radio DJ. And I just rip and ride. And yet I output more podcasts than I do music.
Yeah, exactly. It's a classic side project where you're able to be productive because you weren't even intending to be productive or not productive or whatever. You weren't even thinking about it that much.
Yeah, I don't care if it's a bit scrappy, loose around the edges, you know, rip and ride. So I've got you down here with a definition of creativity. And we've got Csikszentmihalyi's famous one I'm going to read out. Creativity, at least as Csikszentmihalyi defines it in his book, is a process by which a symbolic domain in the culture is changed. New songs, new ideas, new machines are what creativity is all about. So what are your thoughts now on Csikszentmihalyi's view of creativity? And for those people listening to this that have not read the mighty Mihai Csikszentmihalyi's work. Could you give a brief summary of his ideas?
Well, at that point, I'm only rehashing something that I also said in Making Is Connecting, but I wanted to say it at the start. And the thing about even talking about Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's definition, despite the difficulty of saying his name, is that it's... So he did this book called Creativity about 20, 25 years ago by now, probably. And if you're looking for a definition of creativity, like if you just Google it, then this often comes up. And it comes from a book where he was trying to do a kind of sociological study of what are the conditions in which the most amazing kind of creativity happens, which is a very reasonable thing to do. You know, he's trying to unlock, and he's looking for the kind of cultural and social environments which enable creativity to flourish, which is a very interesting question. So that's fine. But because he wants to explore that, he needs to define creativity at the start. And so he defines it setting a really high bar where he's looking at people who've literally won the Nobel Prize for their creativity and things like that. People have come up with the most amazing things. And then he wants to see what are the conditions that enabled those things to arise. And he's not treating them as individual geniuses. His whole thing is to talk about the context in which they're able to create strikingly new things and for those things to be appreciated by their peers, which means that then we later on know that these things occurred. Otherwise, we simply wouldn't know that they even happened. So all of that makes perfect sense. But it means he's got this definition which sets the bar incredibly high and says that you've got to be inventing something that nobody's ever seen before, ever. And as a definition of creativity, it, for general purposes, it's just really intimidating and kind of exclusionary, and is sort of saying that if you're there in your studio making some bit of music and somebody wanders in and goes, oh, that's great, it's really creative, and you feel really pleased with it, that amounts to nothing because you didn't win a Nobel Prize. But people are being creative all the time in their lives, obviously, and there's literally millions of people being creative all the time, or some of the time when they can. They're not winning Nobel Prizes, but they're finding it really fulfilling. Yeah. And maybe their work is appreciated by, you know, 4 people or 10 people or maybe 1,000 people or maybe 10,000 people. They're still not winning Nobel Prizes. That doesn't matter. That's not even important, because the rewards of creativity come from doing it, for one thing, as we've already mentioned. And if the doing is supreme, then who cares about the bar that has been set by Csikszentmihalyi? And also, he didn't mean any harm by setting it. It's just that that wasn't his intention. But when it becomes abstracted as this definition of creativity, then it's very punishing and would lead you to think, oh, I'm not even creative because, you know, I've only released 3 albums and not any of them won a Grammy. So,
yeah, I'm glad you said that, because since I discovered Csikszentmihalyi's work and wrote academically, I felt that it actually is one of the few things I've learned that I think has become a barrier to making. And it is that height of that high jump suddenly is intimidating on your everyday practice of, is this going to change the domain? Well,
yeah,
that's an impossible ask when you're actually making something, because as soon as you start thinking in that way, you can't make anything at all. It's absolutely paralyzing. And I experimented teaching this concept to students because it's a brilliant concept. I mean, he's a master academic, and he has, I think, nailed the closest academic definition to how creativity works as a system. But confusingly, knowing that system as a maker seems to have the opposite effect, certainly on me and the students I taught it to, because it's intimidating, demoralizing, unrealistic, and it derails you so quickly that I felt really intimidated to make work. And prior to knowing that, I didn't think about it. I didn't really understand how it all worked. I just went about my business of making stuff. And this is what I think is so good about your book. Your book doesn't argue that it doesn't matter. And that's something I've not been able to... That's a piece of knowledge I've not been able to unknow. I know it matters, right? I know that if we make work and we want to put it out into the world, I know it matters. But what I think is great about your contribution to the creativity literature field is that you've argued everyone's contribution matters, because without all of those contributions, there is no domain to change. And no creator makes one piece of work, releases it, changes the domain, and then quits.
Yeah. That comes back to the body of work thing again.
Yeah.
No, thank you for saying that. And yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And yeah, another way of saying what you're saying is that Csikszentmihalyi has taught you that creativity exists in a system, and it's only when everything, all the parts of the system are kind of working in harmony with you, that it gets recognized and celebrated and you get to break through and all of that. But the thing to remember in that is, and the thing that you can take from it as a positive, I suppose, is that you can't do anything about any of that system. I mean, you do exist in a culture and a context and all of that, but you can't really control any of that. The only thing you can control is yourself and your contribution to it. Mm. And therefore, if you look at it the other way, it's just not worth thinking about any of that other stuff. The only thing that you can do is just to try to do your best work and maybe nudge the system and the context in which you're in so that it's going to be a bit more receptive. But that's really hard, as you said.
Yeah.
So the only thing you can lean into is just trying to do good stuff and add to your body of work. Try to get it noticed, if you like, because otherwise the system's not going to notice because you haven't done anything to try to be like, hey, look, I've made this thing. But that's all you can do. And a thing that I've even more come to think that I sort of felt before, but through doing this book and talking about this book, I've come even more to think that, like, the doing is the only thing. It's the one thing that you've got some control over, that you can enjoy, and that is the actual nourishing thing in your life. And beyond that, you can't do that much about it. And that meant that I was finally able to come up with a good answer to the AI question. Because, you know, if you talk about creativity, well, then these days you get all people coming up going, yeah, but computers could do it all now, can't they? And, like, what's the point in being a creator anymore if there's a computer down the street which is producing amazing artworks, which people do find satisfying, and you know, which are basically better than what you're doing? That's the basic point. But I've got a perfect answer to that. If the main thing about creativity is the doing of it for you as the creator, then literally, who cares if there's a computer down the street churning out artworks that may or may not be better than my artworks? And, you know, it's making this massive pile of artworks down the street, or music down the street, or whatever. That makes literally no difference to me, because I'm not in competition with it. Even if it has made artworks that are better than my artworks, whatever that would mean, it doesn't matter. It's not making a difference, because the rewarding and powerful thing about creativity is me doing the creativity, or you doing the creativity. That is its value. So you're literally not in competition with a computer that's also trying to do the same thing. And that's not going to make any difference. And it can churn out works for as long as it likes. Millions of them. Makes no difference to you and to me. So hooray, thank goodness, because otherwise those people asking that question think that they found the ultimate reason why you should just give up, but it's not that.
Well, I took this extract from the book. When you're making one song, one YouTube video, one game, one quirky fashion idea, it seems unlikely that your little thing's going to make much of a difference, but of course that is the only way the differences are made, through small single actions which add up to bigger things and feed back into the loop. There's not even another way. No new idea begins massive. It only becomes big when it becomes part of the cycle of culture, when the seed is nurtured and flourishes. Well said in your book.
Well, yeah, well said me.
But that's a real call to arms. And it's so true. And I can't believe that in all my years of being burdened with the Csikszentmihalyi definition, I never realised that no idea can become big without it being small first. It's like a big tree. You can't just have a big tree, which you also talk about. Okay, so chapter 2, experimenting. Systems thinking, cybernetics and art school.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about creativity in education. And yes. I was fascinated to see that our conversations about Westminster music, creativity and art schools arrived in the book.
And yeah, I'm literally talking about you and your art school idea.
So my question to you, who also works in an art school, is we've had a fairly radical version of art school in the 70s that I think I idolise, and I think you probably idolise it too. Having read Philip Glass's book, he talks fondly about Juilliard, where for 3 years you could do whatever you wanted, go to any class, any module, anything, and you just had one final piece of work at the end that you submitted. To me, that sounds utopian, joyful, the kind of educational experience I would like. However, knowing the relationship students now have with education, the fees, the anxieties, that probably isn't their ideal. And we've settled on a modular format where everything's broken down into smaller chunks and components. So I think my question to you is, what do you think the future is of creativity, art schools, and the relationship between education and employment as we go into the 21st century?
Well, that's quite a big question. Well, as you say, it obviously has this kind of built-in trajectory where there's more and more student debt, and students want, understandably, are concerned about, like, what job am I going to get at the end of this? And that's the kind of context in which we find ourselves. And I don't blame them for asking that question.
Because that's not really the point of art school, is it? What job am I going to get after spending 3 years carrying around a plank of wood to understand my relationship with space, or being pushed around in a shopping trolley to understand your relationship with communication and people?
Exactly. but that's the context. And then within that context, we need to be pushing back as much as we can to say, honestly, we're trying to do these things that will unlock your creativity, which will be vital if you want to be doing creative work in the future. But you're always pushing against the instinct of the institution, and also students and parents having learnt those instincts and thinking that they seem quite sensible, which, you know, they do to a certain extent, to always be trying to make it more ordinary. It's our literal job to make it less ordinary and try to do as many weird things as we can, because they're the things that students are going to remember and thank us for later on.
I'm going to phrase the question a different way, because I know how much you like lists and numbers. So I'm going to say, David, if you could change the creative education model with three magic wishes, what three things do you think you would do if you could do anything?
I think they'd all be very unpopular is the problem. And also, if I was going to think of three things, I would sit down and think about it for half an hour and write down three things, or maybe for 3 minutes, instead of just trying to say them with my mouth, which is
what about what about why we do it together. But what about
give me a go.
What about let's banish student fees?
Oh yeah, oh, can we change all of that context?
Okay. Yeah, we can do whatever we want. So get rid of student fees, which radically changes the relationship between the students and the education.
Yeah, and just as an aside on that, I remember there being a point, I can always remember where I was when I heard it. I was in the foyer of the University of Westminster, where you and I have both spent some time. And I heard this thing that was in the news, that the cost to the government of student loans and the whole system of student loans had become greater than the cost that it was or would be if they just literally give students the money. And at that point, I thought, oh my God.
That's great. Actually, that was a wounded noise. That was like being hit by an arrow in the woods.
Yeah, that's so crazy that the cost of having a system where people get into debt was greater than a system where you just didn't charge them any money or maybe give them a grant. So, oh my goodness.
I'm answering my own question. Well, there's bureaucracy gone mad thing. Number two would be, for me, I'm answering the question I set now.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Number two would be to readdress the relationship between ideas from the head and work and ideas from the hands. I think that Western culture has become, over many hundreds of years, to believe that ideas that originate in the head are better and more valuable than ideas that come from the hands, the body, and the makers. And I think that a radical readdress of this issue would really contribute to arts, culture, and education.
Yes, that's a good one.
That's number two.
You want to do number three now as well, don't you?
One
thing that speaks to you're going for really big changes, but one thing, even if it's not a specific thing, but one thing I'm reminded of in this bit of conversation is the whole movement of ungrading. Have you heard about ungrading lately? I love all of the ungrading stuff. I do ungrading now. Obviously, it means that I don't judge your work anymore. But students still want to grade because they live in a context where they expect to get grades and they want to get good grades because they're in competition with everybody else that's getting grades. So they have to have something. So you let them grade themselves, basically. They write process letters to them about what they've been doing and how they've learned something that, you know, so they've advanced during the course of the course. Because they know what they started with. You don't know what they've started with. You've got 90 students. You don't know anything about their background and the context and what they learnt before and what they felt they could do before and what they didn't feel. And you can have conversations with them and try to learn that, but you don't really get that in detail for all 90 because that's impossible. Mm-hmm. They know that. They can narrate that. And they're surprisingly honest about it if you give them the chance. And one thing within the discussion about ungrading that I really like is pushing back on the idea that, oh, in the real world, X and Y happens. Like, we do all these punishing and evaluating kind of things to students, and we rank them against their peers because we say, well, you need to get used to this because that's what happens in the real world kind of thing. But actually, the real world isn't like that. And in the world of work, it's not so punishing. And it's not like you turn up at work on a Monday morning and somebody's posted on the wall a list of employees from best to worst. You know, that doesn't happen. You might have a meeting with your supervisor once every 6 months where they say that, you know, it was a bit disappointing what you did with the photocopier and they wish that you hadn't done this and that. But you're not humiliated on a regular basis in the world of work like you are in the world of school or university. Mm-hmm. And you're certainly not evaluated in that way that sets you up in competition with the other ones in the room and all of that. I find it really heartening that people exist that want to point this out and to point out that when you go, well, you need to get used to this because it's like the real world, you go, actually, is that like the real world at all? Because we're so used to sort of going, we're so used to imagining or pretending that the real world is this punishing kind of place. Mm. Obviously, there's problems with the real world. I acknowledge that. But it's not always as punishing as what we pretend in education, where we're like, well, we have to give you a bad time because you're going to get a bad time later. But why do we have to give you a bad time? Even if you were going to get a bad time later, why do we have to give you a bad time now? Mm. We have to give you space to learn about yourself and to learn what your passions are and to flourish a bit, because then you're probably going to be a bit happier.
I think I would take that point on another notch. And I think something that we don't do in education that is very much real world practice is a feedback loop between the employee or the hired craftsperson or the hired maker and the person hiring them. So if you've hired me to make a piece of music or produce your new CD, you would send me some stuff, I'd send it back, then you wouldn't just grade me. You would send me some comments and then I'd send it back again. And then you'd send me some more comments. And I don't think we're enculturing students into the actual real world practice of working collaboratively with people and responding to and understanding feedback.
Yeah, that's very true. Again, partly because we just don't have the resources, because doing that for the 90 students that I previously mentioned would be extremely time consuming. But
every academic listening to this is going to be like, stop talking. The last thing we want is marked work to come back again.
That's true.
But that's what I think.
If we refer to your point number one or point number two, we're going to get a ton more resources anyway, so it's fine. You're only going to be doing this for six students.
So, We can't talk about art schools without touching on Roy Ascot, because he, to me, is a bit of an art school hero. And I hadn't read any of his actual words before. I'd only ever heard Brian Eno talking about Roy Ascot.
Yeah, exactly. Me too, yeah.
So I was delighted that you'd actually included Roy Ascot's actual words in your book. And I dug them out, yeah. Yeah, I copied them down because I love them. And actually, it's such a call to arms. I want to get these printed and put on the wall. But I'm going to read them out back to you. Culture okay. regulates and shapes society. The artist functions socially on a symbolic level. They act out the role of the individual par excellence. Having chosen the symbolic field within which they act and setting for themselves material limitations with which they are familiar, they set out to discover the unknown. They stake everything on finding the unfamiliar, the unpredictable. The artist's intellectual audacity is matched only by the vital originality of the forms and structures they create. Symbolically, they take on the responsibility for absolute power and freedom to shape and create the world. They demonstrate, perhaps ritualistically, humankind, his capacity to create what is to be. In this context, the artist activity is as significant as the artwork they produce. That's a really powerful paragraph. I didn't realise I was doing that when I'm making noodles on the modular.
Exactly. And to clarify for your listeners, the point, because that's quite a lot of text, but the basic point is the role of the artist, in a sense, is just to exist, doing your thing, creating sort of for the sake of it, raising some questions about the world in which we live. But it's nice that the role of the artist is just to be an artist. It's not necessarily to, you know, to be producing product. And it doesn't need to be the most noticeable product. The public role of the artist is just to be an artist and for people to know that there's artists in the world, because that makes a huge difference. That's nice.
And you also set little challenges in this book, which I am very looking forward to doing. But I wondered what you would answer to your own challenge questions. So I'm going to ask you. Uh-huh. My name is...
All right.
You've got to fill in these gaps.
You're doing the worksheet then.
So I'm going to be the worksheet and you're going to be the person answering it.
Okay.
My name is...
I believe this is the artist statement worksheet. David.
Yeah. And I make...
Let's do it for music. You're invited to pick a particular thing. So cool. Music. Electronic music.
I've been inspired by...
Well, part of this, to diverge from doing your actual task, is that I say do it once and then you come up with the most obvious things and you say... But I try to avoid saying like Brian Eno because that's even more obvious than what I want to write down this week. So I've been inspired by nature, water, an idea of peace. But what I was about to be saying is that I invite you to do it once, but then do it again, which seems ridiculous because you've already done it once. You think, oh, why do I have to do it again? But when you do it for the second time, you put down all the things that aren't the most obvious things in your brain, but which are meaningful to you. You have to think a bit harder. And the second time around, it's better. But I'm not asking you to make me do this twice. Come on.
Because then your name might be next time Brian. So, well, to me, I love this idea.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
No, I think it's great because it's constantly attempting to help you realign with what you're trying to do with that particular making space.
Uh-huh.
Maker space. So for me, I haven't done this, so I'm going to do it live on the podcast. My name is Matt, but I am contemplating releasing music under my middle name, Climber, which I've been contemplating for a long time. And I make music. I've been inspired by nature and the complex patterns in nature, but how they appear to be... They appear quite simply, but arrive at infinite levels of complexity. I seek to manifest that complex system into modular synthesized music. I didn't understand the values of.
You don't need to understand it. It's inviting you to... But it's like, what are your values?
My values... I think with music are to use music as a way to unlock the transcendental experience of being alive that we so often forget in our day-to-day existence. And I think music is one of the most potent forms to connect you to that space, that otherness, that sense of atomic connection to the cosmos.
Yeah.
I started this because I often feel anxious and overwhelmed and trapped and unsatisfied by life's daily patterns, chores, jobs. And making music connects me to that sense of wonder, flow, space, universal oneness that makes me feel part of something much bigger than myself. And now I feel great.
Okay.
How did I do?
Well, it's not a thing that I'm going to be grading, but
are you not going to give me a mark?
Yeah, I liked all of that.
You can ungrade me. But that was really useful. I didn't really think about it like that, but that was really useful.
The bit I like best is the last bit, which says, I started it because ... but now I feel ... And you always get great stuff from that because, you know, people are going to be like, well, you know, I started it because I didn't feel that interested, but I wanted to be closer to my son who liked doing the thing.
Yeah.
But now I feel it's like the most special thing we do together, that kind of thing. Or in my case with making music, I started it because I suddenly realized that you could, which amazingly for like 45 years or something, it hadn't really occurred to me that making recorded music was a thing I could actually do, despite having enjoyed a lot of recorded music and taken a lot of interest in how it was made and all of that.
Yeah.
It didn't really occur to me I could do it myself. I hadn't thought of that. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay.
Well, I was delighted that you did, yeah, because I remember inviting you to the studio. And at the time I was thinking, well, I'd like to invite David into the studio. He'll probably be too busy to want to come. And then I felt a bit anxious that I sort of was taking time out of your busy life to come and essentially hang out in the music studio. And then afterwards, it turned out that you felt quite the opposite. You were really excited to be there. And and I was going to say, what was the process for you of making music? And how did you, you know, what barriers did you face psychologically to do that? And how did you overcome them?
Okay. You're talking about it almost in the past tense as though it was a thing I did, but I continue to make music. And I'm, you know,
but to me, the thing you did was you became visible making music. Uh-huh. So you actually completed the cycle and you released it. So it appeared in the the great garden of life.
Yeah. And especially at first, like, I didn't talk about the fact that I did it for quite a long time. It was kind of, because it seemed a bit embarrassing, and that sort of trope of like sort of middle-aged man in his little room trying to make some electronic music seemed like too predictable.
But that's the resistance talking, isn't it?
I guess. I'd also just sort of naturally like, I didn't want people to laugh at me, basically. And I didn't know if what I could produce would be anything that would be any good. One thing I find interesting now is that who knows what any good actually means, but like I can make things that sound really great to me, and of course they sound really great to me because I'm making the kind of sounds that I like, you know, even sort of, I don't know how brains work, but like there must be particular kind of timbres and sort of sorts of sound and little, and like there's probably certain pitches and things that my very specific brain really likes, and obviously I'm trying to feed that because then my brain's like, oh yeah, that sounds good. But there's absolutely no guarantee that anybody else would think, you know, it won't appeal to them in exactly the same way anyway, because we've all got very specific brains, you know, it's this massive biological matter and it's going to respond to certain things, and other people will just have totally different responses, so there's not even any particular reason to think that anybody else would like it. And also one thing I find interesting about making music at the minute is like I now do talk about doing it, and I've released it, and I even played some stuff live at my book launch, which we can talk about if you want, because that was an interesting process. I sort of don't mind if people don't like it, because I'm amazingly for me at least, at one with the idea that maybe they won't, and that's okay.
And you've Whereas written a before, book about how that's also okay.
Yeah, I'm just trying to reassure myself. That's why I wrote the book. Yeah, quite literally. But like with other things I've done, you always want them to be well received. And like with writing books or something, I wouldn't want somebody to look at one of my books and just think, well, that's kind of predictable rubbish. I've always wanted those things to be well received. But for some reason with music, I've actually managed to get to the space, I think, where I kind of don't mind. And I'm like, And there's a thing I said at my book launch, which I was quite pleased with my metaphor, that like making and releasing music these days, especially for people like me and maybe you, but you're much more experienced and better known than I am. But like it's like arriving on a planet with a basket of cakes. And the cakes are really good cakes, and you've made them with some love and care. But you've arrived on a planet which is literally made of delicious cakes. So the cakes that you made, they're really good. It's not that they're bad. It's not that they're rubbish. Or, you know, it's not that you haven't done them well. You've got nice cakes. But also, you've landed on a planet which is just made of really good cakes. And I think music's like that, because it's like there's so much of it. It's not that difficult to make something that sounds all right, at least, with technology being where it's at right now, and also to put it out in the world. So there's just so much of it, and trying to attract anybody's attention to it seems like sort of, I can understand why that would be impossible, and therefore I can forgive myself if nobody else seems to care that much, because like, why would they? And there's lots of other perfectly good things around. Like writing a book about creativity during the past 5 years, say, there's maybe been, I don't know, now my brain's got stuck, but like maybe it's like books that are sort of in the same sort of vein as my book, maybe there's 5 or 10 of those or something, maybe less. So there's much less competition, so you definitely want it to stand out and to do well and for people to notice it. Releasing music, there's just such a massive ocean of music that you can't expect anyone to pay attention, and that's okay. It'd be nice if they did. And also, if somebody made some really wounding remark, just to show that I'm not immune, if somebody just thought it was dreadful, I wouldn't like that. And that is the comment that sticks in your mind, even when you've got 20 other people that thought it was good. So there's still that. But I seem to be surprisingly okay with it not necessarily being the thing that the whole world seems to want. And I'm still going to do it because I like doing it. And I like the idea of persisting, adding to the body of work. Maybe at some point further down the line, then it will be a body of work that's some decent number of people think is good. And at the minute, maybe not. That's okay, because I'm just starting to build the body of work. So that's okay.
So how did you... What was the moment when you overcame the barrier to getting it done and releasing it? Because that can be a challenging experience. I'm working on a track at the moment, and I'm going to meet a label tomorrow to talk about releasing it. And that moment between it being finished and out and not finished and out, I actually feel like I'm being attacked. The chest contracts. I feel breathless, anxious that I'm going to be judged. And I know I have to summit that. It's like for a climber when the angle starts curving and you've got that final push up to the summit. How did you overcome that feeling?
Which point are you at for that? That's when you've finished it to your own satisfaction, but you've not played it to anybody else yet. Is that the point you're
talking about? It's 90% of the way there. But I just now got to lock it down and send it.
I mean, I do spend a long time tinkering, but then eventually it gets to a point where I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to be able to make this any better, and this seems about right.
So you just go with the...
happy to be able to sit with it.
You go with the nothing's ever finished, you just abandon it philosophy.
Not exactly, because I'm more of a perfectionist than that, so I do spend a lot of time making some little tinker, and then I, you know, output it again, and then I listen to it on my phone, and I listen to it in the car, and then there's always some little bit I want to change, and so on and so on and so on, for a number of iterations. But then it gets to a point that I think, well, I think that's about done, and that doesn't really stress me out. The bit that used to make me most squeamish was the bit when you just, like, if you sort of release it into the abstract world, that's fine. But if you actually, like, with a person and they play it, or something, you have to actually see their face at the point where they're actually listening to it kind of thing. That's a bit like... Like, I did it for my first EP. I don't know if it was my idea, but the people I worked with wanted to do a sort of listening party thing for it. And at first I thought, oh, that's just... It's even hard because of just, like, the social thing of, like, with music... Like, what do you do with your face when there's actually, like, there's a group of people there, and one of you is the person that made the music, so that's me. Then there's all the other people, and you're listening to, like, 5 minutes of stuff. And, you know, if you're watching a film, you will just, like, attend to the film, and it's very straightforward because you know what to do with your face because you're just, like, looking at the film, so that's fine. But with music, well, then it's only coming into your ears, and then people have to address the problem of what they do with all the rest of their body while the stuff's coming into their ears. And so that was potentially like,
What did you do with your face?
I looked diffident and slightly apologetic, probably. but it was okay, you know, they liked it. And that was very affirming for me. And also playing my stuff live, which I did on the 8th of December of my book launch, having worked out how the hell I could even play things live, it had a good reception. I pushed on through the embarrassment, basically. But there is a significant level of embarrassment and possibly shame. So my solution to that is to literally talk about that before playing the track. So having talked about how you're doing this difficult thing, which is potentially humiliating and shameful, and having used those words, then everyone's really on side. It wasn't meant to be psychological manipulation.
You shouldn't feel shame like that. Because what you're doing is a beautiful thing of a human creating art.
Yeah, but also you're making all these people sit there and listen to this thing, which may or may not be anything like the kind of thing that they want to listen to.
You didn't make them. Like, they did choose to be there.
They did choose to be there. I mean, it's slightly different to some... Like, if you're an artist that is already known... then the people come because they literally like your stuff already. In this case, these people were coming along because they know me or they've heard about me, and it's primarily a book launch about creativity. But then I'm playing my music to them, but they haven't necessarily asked for it. But by literally saying, I know you haven't asked for this, and I'm going to do it anyway, that made it much better, I think.
Did you bring cake to fully hit home with your metaphor?
Oh, I see. I didn't bring cake, but I did give them food and drink, again, in a sort of apologetic manner to make up for the fact that I played this music at them.
Always forgiven if you give someone some food.
As loud as I can. Yeah.
Mm. And that kind of brings us on. I'm skipping over chapter 3, doing, because I think we've talked a lot about doing. But this segues nicely into chapter 4, inspiration, where we hit Brené Brown, Joyful Simplicity. And I love what Brené Brown said that you quoted in the book. No matter what gets done and how much is left undone, I am enough. And I think that really connected with me, as I just never seem to get enough done in the day. And I often go to bed feeling quite... I don't think ashamed is the right word, but frustrated, disappointed, a feeling of lacking, even though I work so hard and so efficiently.
Yes.
It's never enough. And Brené Brown always makes things better.
Yeah, it is nice to be told that you are enough, isn't it?
And
it's so hard to think that about yourself, because even if you're not like the most punishingly self-critical person, we always feel like we're failing in so many ways because there's so many things that we have to do in life all the time, and it's just not possible to do them all. It's so common to just feel bad about how you're doing, but that's not really fair. We're all doing our best.
And then your book nicely segues from Brené Brown into sort of minimalism and simplicity. And I loved what you chose to include about minimalism. And I was wondering, when writing the book, at what point did you sort of get into the sort of music of Camaru and the minimalist concepts? Was that from the start, or did it sort of arrive halfway through?
It partly derives from the story I tell in the book about when I was doing a drawing a day.
Yeah.
And I realised that the most satisfying thing was, I had this such a strong feeling that I wanted to just draw one line. And the pressure, the sort of implicit pressure in a drawing a day is that you need to do a drawing of something or a drawing that looks kind of interesting. And I just wanted to draw a line. And there was a day when I wanted to draw a line, but I bottled it. And drew a tree instead, because I couldn't bring myself to just draw a line, because it didn't seem enough. To go back to the enough point, it seemed like insufficient. But then the next day, because I'd done the tree, then I thought, why did I do a tree? I just wanted to draw a line. And then for the next 24 hours, I was literally looking forward to just drawing a line. And I did just draw a line, and it felt great to just draw a line. And then I wrote 3 pages of commentary about the drawing of the line, which also the written down text counts as part of the drawing in a way. But but I found that incredibly exciting, even though it's seemingly nothing. And it's very hard to do little, I think. And in music making, I often start off with the idea with the idea of something that's kind of beautifully pure and simple and like the least I could possibly do. And none of my tracks ends up ever being anything like that, because I always want to put things in. You want it to be interesting. You don't want people to be bored. So I never, ever, ever... And I always, when I've finished some complicated track with lots of interesting things going on, and I'm pleased with that, I always put that aside and then think, okay, so now I'm going to do like the ultimate ambient thing that goes on for 4 hours and nothing happens at all. And I never do that. In a sense, it'd be sort of easier to do, except it wouldn't be easier to do, because you still want it to be interesting. You want it to be interesting but peaceful and not have too much in it. And I always... the track that I'm going to release next is the live version of October, which is possibly my favourite track of my tracks that I've done so far. And in doing it live... Because you have to create a thing that you can actually generate live, I had to break it down into its sort of constituent parts and put them all as separate stems, essentially, into an MPC One big golden box with buttons that I could just press buttons to trigger things. And I was able to arrive at sort of the ultimate form, because you've got it down into simple blocks, which means that... I'm not doing too much, or there's not too many extra little bells and whistles that I've added, and there's not too many kind of extra bits of effect that I've put in here and there just to try to make it seem interesting. And I like it much better when it's arrived at a point where I'm not trying too hard. And I always am trying too hard, basically. And maybe I pedal back from that, and I'm not dissing all my own tracks, because I think I do like the music I've produced. Actually, I think I've done surprisingly well on my own standards, not by anybody else's standards, but I didn't think that I'd be able to produce things that are as satisfying to me as these ones are. Even though they're dissatisfying in all kinds of ways, especially when they've got my voice on. Anyway, I've lost my whole track now, but it's about getting it to a point where it doesn't have too much in, and I don't seem like I'm trying over hard, and then it is satisfying. But it's always that thing about taking stuff away and trying too hard and then ruining it by trying too hard and trying to take things out again.
I like this challenge that you've written in the book for this chapter. And it's something I'm going to explore for the Down the Rabbit Hole series of this episode. What is the smallest possible element of your creative practice that you can do? Just doing the simplest possible theme and then being satisfied that that is enough to be perfect. And then that also recalls the point from Michael Rother you made, who I... also like, if you can appreciate this 5% of the horizon, that can be enough. So he talks, Michael Rother, which you know because you wrote it, so I'm quoting it back to you.
Carry on.
I love the idea that he says that the stars all look close together, but then when you get closer, of course they seem miles apart. And I think this, again, connecting back to that Csikszentmihalyi concept of creativity, where to be good enough, you've got to change the entire domain that you're operating in. You can often feel, of course, that your music or creative output is similar in some respects to other people's. But then actually when you inhabit a world, for me, minimalism and ambience and all things kind of in that vein, there's a world of difference between all of the artists that release music in that space, even though when you zoom out, it feels close together. So I knew that academically, but I think I often fear, you know, moving into releasing music, a new project, I feel fearful that I'm going to be a second or third rate, you know, Gold Panda or, you know, but we've cut, or Forte, but we've come, you inevitably have some of the same influences of other people, and you do have different ones, but you're going to be somewhere, you know, looking far away as a star close to their star. But I found that a really beautiful explanation of space, that it is dependent on the perspective.
Yeah. And you can't be too punishing with yourself about the ways in which it is going to have some influences that are, you know, some common touchstones or something. Can you? And I like the idea that... like when you hear something by an artist that you really like, if you're like me at least, it's really common to sort of think about how they did that and to be excited for a moment about wanting to do that, basically. You sort of think, oh, how can I do a thing that's like that? And you sort of think, oh, that's a great kind of idea or sound or something. And you start thinking about how you can do that. But of course, that's a really stupid idea because they're already doing that and they're doing it really well already, which is why you liked it. So there's literally no point in trying to do that anyway. And instead you bring your own thing. And because your own thing is going to be different and you can't do what they're doing, that's fine. Because no one wants you to be doing what they're doing anyway, because they're already doing it. So that's completely pointless. But, so I like the way in which that affirms whatever it is that you do bring yourself, which is by definition going to be different from what other people are doing and will be interesting because it's different. That's nice. That's a nice thing to be able to say to students as well, because, you know...
well, as Austin Kleon said, and I've still got the calendar you bought me that I love, the human hand is incapable of making a perfect copy. So even if you are trying to copy something, it often comes out differently.
Yeah.
Okay, so chapter six, keep going. Talking of Austin Kleon, you nicked this title from the man himself, didn't you? Because that's one of his books.
Well, but I would say I always loved the idea of keeping going, and then he did a book called Keep Going. But I do like the phrase. I do like the phrase.
It's great.
And because Austin Kleon's got a book called Keep Going, I tried to give that chapter a different title. It could have been called like Persisting or something like that. But I just like Keep Going is a really powerful phrase to me, I think. And I think it's like the whole challenge, it's almost, the whole challenge of creativity is just about how do we keep going?
So you've got some challenges here. Start before you are ready. Release early, release often. Feel the fear and do it anyway. I've heard them before, but I think I'd forgotten. I think this is one of the issues. We forget this stuff. We read it. We go, that's really good.
Yeah.
And then we forget it again. And I want those on my wall.
Yeah, that's a bit where I was hoovering up three different powerful phrases all in one go because they're good ones. But especially feel the fear and do it anyway. I think it's so powerful in all parts of life. And in fact, that phrase is meaningful for me because you're also... I don't think I name you in that bit of story, and I don't know if I tell this bit of story in the book, but you're in this one again because you invited me to speak to the music students, and I'd never spoken to music students, and you emailed me quite late one night and said, oh, what's it called? Because I had to give it a title or something. And so I said, feel the fear, creativity, colon, feel the fear and do it anyway, because that seemed like a good title at 11:30 at night or whatever. And then the next day I thought, oh no, that's the name of an actual book. And I've never read the book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And really, there was about 4 days to go or something. And I thought, oh no. So I had to get it from Amazon really quick to see what was in this book. Because it would be wrong to steal the title of a book and not even know anything about what the actual book actually said. And you know how the self-help books in the world, which basically just say the thing that is in their title or on their back cover, and that's all they say for 300 pages. That's really disappointing. Yeah. They give you a bunch of different examples and stuff, and it's just the same point. But Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway did not do that. It had all kinds of different fascinating ways of unpacking this basic idea. And it is good. And there's a bit in it. What's the bit that's really good? There's a bit that says, it's really common to think that I won't do the fearful thing now because I don't feel ready or I don't feel enough. And basically I'll be doing it at some point in the future. But the reality is that you will never... Oh, no, no. What it is I don't feel... Sorry. I don't feel I can do it now because I'm... It's basically like I don't feel able to do it now, but at some later point I think I will be able to. But in fact, the only way that you will feel good enough about yourself, that's what it is. You don't feel good enough about yourself to be able to do it. And so you don't do it. But the only way you will feel good enough about yourself is if you do do it. It's only through the doing of it that you come to feel okay about yourself enough to be able to do the thing. So you always have to do the thing. And feel the fear and do it anyways, a thing that sometimes we have to talk about. I talk about it with my kids sometimes, and I think it in my own mind about doing, you know, the things that we wish that we didn't have to do or things that have seemed scary. I think it is very good because you feel better through having done the thing. So the only way to feel better is through doing the thing.
Yeah,
didn't explain that very well, but you know what I
mean. Well, you got there in the end, and that's the most important
thing.
Got
there in the end, sorry. Thanks.
I mean, for me, the one that resonated the most was release early, release often. And that was my whole journey into modular, was I wanted a way to remove the endless tinkering that you can do on a computer system with music and move much... Oh. Hi, Matt. Hey, would you have coffee? Sorry. Alexa, what? Announce. Oh. That would be great. Thanks, Meg. That's very nice of Meg. Yeah, for me, I wanted to go back to earlier models of music making where the performance was what was recorded. So pre-sound on sound models where you're getting creative takes. And there is something so dynamic and human and engaging about that process that I think, as much as I love modern music and it's opened up a new space, I think to me, I respond incredibly well to music that's made in that way. And I was listening to this great show on BBC Six by Tom Ravenscroft. I don't know if you've heard it, but the last episode was with James Holden, who's a musician I adore. And I was going to send him your way because I'm not sure you've engaged with James Holden. But I think you'd really like what he does, because a lot of the way you perceive things and making, he embodies. So as an artist, he makes all of his own quirky kind of plugins, and he 3D prints buttons to do stuff with, but then makes this incredible music with these very interesting processes. And his last album before the recent one was, I can't remember the exact title, but something to do with spirits. And that was all live recordings. So, yeah, I got into that process to essentially record performances. And I've been recording them now daily for, I think, 4 years. So I've got this enormous archive of live recordings.
Wow.
But haven't brought myself to put them out because of the fear. So I suppose, yeah, I said I was responding to release early, release often. And I haven't actually got to the final point in your list, which is feel the fear and do it anyway. I just need to put them out.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you? No one's going
chapter
to
seven,
and laugh.
Becoming.
Yeah, go on then.
Write a list of your unbound wishes. Thing. What would you make if it made no difference to anyone, if there were no rules or expectations? What would you make, David?
Well, it's a good one, isn't it? Because... I mean, when I set challenges to students, I always, like in class, I always do them myself at the same time to experience what it's like to have set them the thing. And these challenges that you're reading out is basically, as you might guess, because the publisher was like, oh, it'd be good. Because I did have the artist statement worksheet in there, which is the thing you're invited to do, because I like that. And because I'd done that in one chapter, then they're like, wouldn't it be good if every chapter had one of these challenges? And so then I had to come up with some. And I didn't want them to be, you know, obvious kind of filler or kind of, hey, now you can do a thing, which I thought was kind of patronizing because people reading the book are already creative people and they don't need to me to be saying, hey, now you can do a thing. But these prompts seem quite good. So having said all of that, what was the prompt again? What would you make if there was no expectations? You could do You didn't have to think about what anybody else
would think. What
would
you make if it didn't make any difference to anyone and there were no rules or expectations?
Yeah. I don't know exactly what it looks like in the world, but in my mind, it's like the ultimate peaceful ambient thing, which maybe involves a painting with... I can picture it. I can't describe... The point of a painting should be that you can't... And the point of music would be that... it needs to be something that you couldn't just say in words. So that's my excuse for not being able to say it in words.
Why does something that can't be said in words.
But something that can't be said. But it's like the ultimate, just an sort of ambient hum. It's a very peaceful and resonant sound which rings in my heart and which really doesn't feel any pressure to do something interesting for quite a long time. Because the reason why I can never do this in the real world is because if I did it in the real world, I'd just think, well, people are going to think that's boring. Or they're going to think I made no effort. And I don't like the idea that people will think that I've made no effort. I'm always trying to demonstrate in some way that I have actually made some effort. but I mean, I'm not always doing that these days. That's the thing I realised during my journey to making creative things. I was just being too annoying by trying to sort of demonstrate that I could do certain stuff to show that I wasn't a complete idiot. And you need to get beyond that point, of course, to start doing anything actually interesting or acceptable to anybody, because nobody wants you to be sort of just trying to show that you're not like a kid who just got Photoshop. Yes, so that was my answer. What would your answer be?
I think I've probably answered that through my modular manifestations. What the criticism that's often thrown at modular synth practitioners is that you've spent arguably probably £9,000 more than someone with a computer, at least, and yet the music has got substantially worse.
Well, that's not true.
As a result of that. But I think the point with getting into modular makes things that are so unbelievably simple to do on the computer unbelievably challenging. Like, you try and make a synthesizer on a modular that can play more than one note even, is it took me 3 years to get to that point where I could actually make a pretty basic synthesizer.
But yeah, but there's got to be a difference in what is produced.
There is. But what modular is brilliant for is rewiring your brain into new ways of thinking about making music and sound. And that was why I think, in answer to that challenge, I think I took that path to modular. So to slow down my creative process, to allow more space and time to think and to make music as if no one cared or was listening or watching. Yeah. And to reconnect with just... the joy of musicking. And I think I was listening, I can't remember who said this, but I was listening to someone talking about electronic music and the difference electronic musicians have with releasing music to, for example, acoustic instrumentalists. So lots of people sit down and play piano and violin and all manner of acoustic instruments and don't feel a guitar and don't feel a huge sense of regret for not releasing that into the world because it doesn't have its own recording mechanism inbuilt. But the fact that electronic music exists in it actually exists in the medium of its release, that electronic musicians can have a much more complicated relationship with releasing their creative practice, either feeling, you know, regretful, you know, as if every practice should be released. So almost.
Yeah.
I thought it was an interesting idea anyway.
But obviously you can spend lots of time with all your electronic stuff and not be recording it. And I'm not sure if it's a way that... It sounds like it could be a way that electronic musicians feel sorry for themselves and treat themselves as exceptional in a way that's different to... But the other artists could have similar kinds of thoughts, couldn't they? I don't know if it's that different.
No.
but it's an interesting thought.
I just thought it's something I not considered. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, no, it is interesting about how it's in the form of its release already. Therefore, guilt trips you about whether it should be released or not.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then the final bits of your book were like all the book again. It was like a greatest hits.
I did a mega mix. It only takes like 2.5 pages, but it's like all the best bits.
It went all Jive Bunny at the end, and we cut and spliced all the best bits into into a chunk. But I was very pleased. I didn't. I resisted the urge to jump straight to the end, and I was delighted that I experienced it in real time. And what I found with your book and the other book that arrived at my door at the same time, which I also usually have around but don't seem to have it to hand, is Rick Rubin's book on creativity. Have you read Rick Rubin's book?
I've got Rick Rubin's book and I've looked at some bits of it, my answer to that. And he is, I don't know why I want to say surprisingly thoughtful, because I've heard him on podcasts and things, but he's surprisingly thoughtful and kind of zen about it all. I thought, go on, what did you get from Rick Rubin's book?
Well, no, I got from both your and Rick Rubin's book. They were both very, how would I describe this? Like a physical experience. So you talk, I'm going to put it into David Gauntlet language. In your book, you talk about the white pube, which is some art critics responding to art criticism as a form and changing the form of art criticism for it not to be this kind of overly intellectual, star-rated grading, and to instead write about how the art makes you feel and how you experience it. Both books, I found, allowed me space to feel and experience rather than always academically process. And in that sense, I found them both brilliant companions and galvanized my creativity back to action. I suddenly felt re-empowered to make things again, and that my making was important.
Well, that's nice. Of course your making is important.
Yeah.
Yes. That's great, though. I mean, what better accolade or praise could there be that it actually motivated you to do some actual making, which is the whole point? So that's nice.
And
imagine me being able to persuade you to do that, because you were always my creative inspiration. But now I've managed to finally get a glimpse of turning the tables.
And, well, I thought you'd like that, you because that's good. You know,
I do like that.
Since my transition to being an academic, which was not one I wanted to happen, I made stuff. I like to rock people. I like to support and help people. So I started to teach people. And then suddenly I was wearing a gown, sitting on stage at the Royal Festival Hall as an academic at graduation day. So I've never had a comfortable relationship with being an academic. It's always had a complex relationship, I think, between thinking and doing.
Yeah. And I think I helped you to see how there was a place for Matt Goodison in the academic world and how you could be bringing something really good to it. And thereby ruined your life, because the thing I think I didn't mention, if I was mentioning what I just said, was that it also comes with a whole load of bureaucracy and management, which we never anticipate. And if you're any good at doing your job, they just give you more bureaucracy and management, even though that's not actually what you were good at. What you were good at was teaching or communicating to people and that kind of thing. And therefore ruined your life. But thankfully you found a new job where you'll be able to spend at least 2 years going, oh, I don't know how anything works, until they realise that actually you do know how things work and give you a whole ton more bureaucracy and management. And so then you'll have to leave that job in about another 5 years after that. So.
But I have found, working through, by keeping on going, that I do have a space in academia. And my space and my mission was to bring about more creative practice, more new divergent ways of doing things and thinking, and support those diversities. And represent those cultures, and ultimately, being given a position of power, change them.
Yes.
So that was very exciting.
Good. That's nice. Yeah. No, you did do that. That's true. And then you ran off. You're like, but I know they're going to struggle to put it back to how it was before.
But I've written they can't policies. Put it back entirely
to it. Yes, exactly. It's all locked in now. Very good. Yeah. And I'm sure you've inspired some people to follow in the path and not just put it back how it was before. So that's good.
I hope so. So yes. I would like you to take on the challenge of making a musically minimal your music down to one note, one concept, one pure thing, because I'd love to include that in this podcast, and I'm going to do the same thing.
Yeah, I will
feel the fear
this.
And do it anyway.
Thinking, yeah, I know. I'm already thinking, but and I guess what I said before is already kicking in, because I'm like, won't it seem a bit boring, or like I've made no effort? Because like it could just be like. Yeah, a simple ping and that's it.
Have you heard any Eliana Radigue?
That's not good enough.
Have you heard Eliana Radigue? Eliana Radigue.
I don't think so.
I'll send you some Eliana Radigue, who is the most amazing composer. She's one of the pioneers of electronic music. And yeah, you're going to have some fun listening to her one note.
Okay. I'm always looking for the one note solution.
Well, David, interesting. It's been great. Thank you so much for your time. It's been epic. We've done the entire book.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it when you were like, chapter 3. I thought, oh, this is going to take a long time. But you were just going through the challenges, so that was okay.
I know you like systems. You. I enjoyed it. I know you like systems, so I kept it systematic.
I like
systematic.
A numbered list. Exactly.
I know you like a list. Yep. I know you like systems, and I know you like academically knowing where you are. So then once we got the system locked in, you knew where we were going, where we'd been.
Okay.
I did want to do it.
Very boring and predictable.
As a kid, I loved those Steve Jackson and Ian Livingstone books. I don't know if you had them, with the green spine.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, where you rolled the dice. I woke up this morning and thought, I really want to do the podcast like that, but I just simply didn't have the creative resources and time to do it. Oh. But I thought, wouldn't that be great if we went through it in a kind of Dungeons and Dragons style dice rolling format?
That would be nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
so I think my final question to you is about the future. Creativity, music, systems, and the future. So tomorrow I'm going to meet a label based in the Web3 space. And it's all about decentralized networks and the current revolution. I wonder what your thoughts were on that and how you see that progressing, and what impact do you think that will have on creativity and making?
Well, I'm sorry to throw it back to you, but when you say the Web3 space, what do you even mean these days? There was a thing that people talked about with Web3 like some number of years ago, where it was a particular thing where essentially the system knew what the information was and therefore was sort of able to answer questions for you without somebody having had to write it down already. Is that what you mean? What do you mean something else? And what does that mean when music's in that space? Yeah. And I'm speaking on behalf, obviously I know what it all means, but I'm speaking on behalf of your listeners who may be a bit confused by your question.
Well, my understanding as a novice as well in this, trying to figure it out, is that Web 1 was like CFAX. You put your information up on the screen.
Yeah.
Apparently, Web 2 was you could comment and share and interact with that text. And so Web 3, in my understanding, is you can co-author and co-own. So a bit like a kind of Wikipedia on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of share contracts in the blockchain. So, for example, I could assign, you know, we could write a track together and you could have, we could have 50-50, but we could then say, oh, every listener to this podcast also gets 5% of the song, and we can cut them in and then they can sell it and share it. So it's a sort of co-authorship, ownership space on decentralized networks.
Yes. I've worked out what I can do with your difficult and technical sounding question, which is to lean back into the fact that for me, it's about the doing. And therefore, I don't really mind about any of that. I want to have a good experience of the creativity. And if I can have a good experience just myself, that's fine. If I can do it collaboratively with you, that's also good. And maybe if you've got some technologies that make the collaboration a bit smoother, I suppose that's good. But I don't really care about how we divide up the things afterwards. And or indeed about what anybody else thinks about it.
Good answer.
Pure doing, Matt. It's the doing that is the only thing that gives you the rewards. The real rewards of actually having done a thing and being able to, if you want to, look back on the thing and feel glad that you did the thing, or else just moving on to doing more things. It's the doing of the thing that counts.
What a great summary. Thank you for your time. It's been great to catch up and chat all things creativity.
Thank you, Matt.
I've really loved it.
It was lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
See
you soon.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, that was the immense David Gauntlett talking about all things creativity. He's a real powerhouse and a very, very inspiring man indeed. Did you like it? Yeah, good. So, thanks for getting this far in the podcast. It means you are a super listener. I should reward you with something, but I'm not quite sure what I can reward you with. I don't know. Tell me you've listened this far, write to me, and I will send you something in the post. So send me an email, mattgwoodderson@mac.com. Send me an email at mattgoodderson@mac.com, and I'll send you a special You Survived the Entire Podcast gift. So thanks again for all your support. I'm looking forward to producing the next one of these, which should be available at some point when I get round to it. So yeah, take it easy, have a great day, and I'll see you all soon.